into his rapacious grasp. Judging from the tableau unfolding before me, Jamie's estimate of his grandfather's character hadn't been in error. Jamie had first ridden up alongside young Simon's clerk, and what looked from my vantage point like a heated argument ended when Jamie leaned from his saddle, grabbed the clerk's reins, and dragged the indignant man's horse out of line onto the verge of the muddy track. The two men dismounted and stood face to face, obviously going at it hammer and tongs. Young Simon, seeing the altercation, reined aside himself, motioning the rest of the column to proceed. A good deal of to and fro then ensued. We were close enough to see Simon's face flushed red with annoyance, the worried grimace on the clerk's countenance, and a series of rather violent gestures on Jamie's part. I watched this pantomime in fascination, as the clerk, with a shrug of resignation, unfastened his saddlebag, scrabbled in the depths, and came up with several sheets of parchment. Jamie snatched these and skimmed rapidly through them, forefinger tracing the lines of writing. He seized one sheet, letting the rest drop to the ground, and shook it in Simon Fraser's face. The young fox looked taken aback. He took the sheet, peered at it, then looked up in bewilderment. Jamie grabbed back the sheet, and with a sudden effort ripped the tough parchment down, then across, and stuffed the pieces into his sporran. I had halted my pony, who took advantage of the recess to nose about among the meagre shreds of plant life still to be found. The back of young Simon's neck was bright red as he turned back to his horse, and I decided to keep out of the way. Jamie, remounted, came trotting back along the verge to join me, red hair flying like a banner in the wind, eyes gleaming with anger over tight-set lips.
"The filthy old asswipe," he said without ceremony.
"What's he done?" I inquired.
"Listed the names of my men on his own rolls," Jamie said. "Claimed them as part of his Fraser regiment. Moosey old poutworm."
He glanced back up the track with longing.
"Pity we've come such a wee. It's too far to go back and proddle the old mumper."
I resisted the temptation to egg Jamie on to call his grandfather more names, and asked instead, "Why would he do that? Just to make it look as though he were making more of a contribution to the Stuarts?" Jamie nodded, the tide of fury receding slightly from his cheeks.
"Aye, that. Make himself look better at no cost. But not only that. The wretched old nethercap wants my land back. He has, ever since he was forced to give it up when my parents wed. Now he thinks, if it all comes right, and he's made Duke of Inverness, he can claim Lallybroch has been his all along, and me just his tenant. The proof being that he's raised men from the estate to answer the Stuarts' call to the clans."
"Could he actually get away with something like that?" I asked doubtfully. Jamie drew in a deep breath and released it, the cloud of vapour rising like dragon smoke from his nostrils. He smiled grimly and patted the sporran at his waist.
"Not now he can't," he said.
It was a 2-day trip from Bewley to Lallybroch in good weather, given sound horses and dry ground, pausing for nothing more than the necessities of eating, sleeping, and personal hygiene. As it was, one of the horses went lame 6 miles out of Bewley. It snowed and sleeted and blew by turns. The boggy ground froze in patches of slippery ice, and what with one thing and another, it was nearly a week before we made our way down the last slope that led to the farmhouse at Lallybroch. Cold, tired, hungry, and far from hygienic. We were alone, just the two of us. Murtagh had been sent to Edinburgh with young Simon and the Beaufort men-at-arms to judge how matters stood with the Highland army. The house stood solid among its outbuildings, white as the snow-streaked fields that surrounded it. I remembered vividly the emotions I had felt when I first saw the place.
Granted, I had seen it first in the glow of a fine autumn day, not through sheets of blowing icy snow. But even then it had seemed a welcome refuge. The house's impression of strength and serenity was heightened now by the warm lamplight spilling through the lower windows, soft yellow in the deepening grey of early evening. The feeling of welcome grew even stronger when I followed Jamie through the front door, to be met by the mouth-watering smell of roasting meat and fresh bread. "Supper," Jamie said, closing his eyes in bliss as he inhaled the fragrant aromas. "God, I could eat a horse." Melting ice dripped from the hem of his cloak, making wet spots on the wooden floor. "I thought we were going to have to eat one of them," I remarked, untying the strings of my cloak and brushing melting snow from my hair. "That poor creature you traded in Kirkenmill could barely hobble." The sound of our voices carried through the hall, and a door opened overhead, followed by the sound of small running feet and a cry of joy as the younger Jamie spotted his namesake below. The racket of their reunion attracted the attention of the rest of the household, and before we knew it, we were enveloped in greetings and embraces as Jenny and the baby, little Maggie, Ian, Mrs. Crook, and assorted maidservants all rushed into the hall. "It's so good to see you, my dearie," Jenny said for the third time, standing on tiptoe to kiss Jamie. "Such news as we've heard of the army, we feared it would be months before you came home."
"Aye," Ian said. "Have you brought any of the men back with you, or is this only a visit?"
"Brought them back?"
Arrested in the act of greeting his elder niece, Jamie stared at his brother-in-law, momentarily forgetting the little girl in his arms. Brought to a realization of her presence by her yanking his hair, he kissed her absently and handed her to me.
"What do you mean, Ian?" he demanded. "The men should all have returned a month ago. Did some of them not come home?"
I held small Maggie tight, a dreadful feeling of foreboding coming over me as I watched the smile fade from Ian's face.
"None of them came back, Jamie," he said slowly,
his long, good-humoured face suddenly mirroring the grim expression he saw on Jamie's.
"We have na seen hide nor hair of any of them since they marched to war with you."
There was a shout from the dooryard outside, where Rabbi McNab was putting away the horses. Jamie whirled, turned to the door, and pushed it open, leaning out into the storm. Over his shoulder, I could see a rider coming through the blowing snow. Visibility was too poor to make out his face, but that small, wiry figure, clinging monkey-like to the saddle, was unmistakable.
"Fast as Jean Lightning," Jamie had said,
and clearly he was right. To make the trip from Bewley to Edinburgh and then to Lallybroch in a week was a true feat of endurance. The coming rider was Murtaugh, and it didn't take Marsri's gift of prophecy to tell us that the news he bore was ill. Chapter 42. Reunions. White with rage, Jamie flung back the door of Holyrood's morning drawing-room with a crash. Ewan Cameron leapt to his feet, upsetting the inkpot he'd been using. Simon Fraser, master of Lovett, was seated across the table, but merely raised thick black brows at his half-nephew's entrance.
"Damn!" Ewan said, scrabbling in his sleeve for a handkerchief to mop the spreading puddle with. "What's the matter with you, Fraser? Oh, good morning to you, Mistress Fraser,"
he added, seeing me behind Jamie.
"Where's his Highness?" Jamie demanded, without preamble. "Stirling Castle," Cameron replied, failing to find the handkerchief he was searching for. "Got a cloth, Fraser? If I did, I'd choke you with it," Jamie said.
He had relaxed slightly upon finding that Charles Stuart was not in residence, but the corners of his lips were still tight.
"Why have you let my men be kept in the toll booth? I've just seen them, kept in a place I wouldna let pigs live. Surely to God you could have done something."
Cameron flushed at this, but his clear brown eyes met Jamie's steadily.
"I tried," he said. "I told His Highness that I was sure it was a mistake. Aye, and the 30 of them 10 miles from the army when they were found. Some mistake. And besides, even if they'd really meant to desert, he didn't have such a strength of men that he could afford to do without them. That's all that kept him from ordering the lot of them to be hanged on the spot, you ken," he said, beginning to grow angry as the shock of Jamie's entrance wore off. "Good man, it's treason to desert in time of war."
"Aye," Jamie said sceptically. He nodded briefly to young Simon and pushed a chair in my direction before sitting down himself.
"And have you sent orders to hang the 20 of your men who've gone home, Ewan? Or is it more like 40 now?"
Cameron flushed more deeply and dropped his eyes, concentrating on mopping up the ink with the cloth Simon Fraser handed him.
"They weren't caught," he muttered at last.
He glanced up at Jamie, his thin face earnest.
"Go to His Highness at Stirling," he advised. "He was furious about the desertion. But after all, it was his orders sent you to Bewley and left your men untended, aye? And he's always thought well of you, Jamie, and called you friend. It might be he'll pardon your men, and you beg him for their lives."
Picking up the ink-soaked cloth, he looked dubiously at it, and then, with a muttered excuse, left to dispose of it outside, obviously eager to get away from Jamie. Jamie sat sprawled in his chair, breathing through clenched teeth with a small hissing noise, eyes fixed on the small embroidered hanging on the wall that showed the Stuart coat of arms. The two stiff fingers of his right hand tapped slowly on the table. He'd been in much the same state ever since Murtaugh's arrival at Lallybroch, with the news that the 30 men of Jamie's command had been apprehended in the act of desertion and imprisoned in Edinburgh's notorious Tolbooth prison under sentence of death. I didn't myself think that Charles intended to execute the men. As Ewan Cameron pointed out, the Highland army had need of every able-bodied man it could muster. The push into England that Charles had argued for had been costly, and the influx of support he had foreseen from the English countryside hadn't materialised. Not only that, to execute Jamie's men in his absence would have been an act of political idiocy and personal betrayal too great even for Charles Stuart to contemplate. No, I imagined that Cameron was right, and the men would be pardoned eventually. Jamie undoubtedly realised it too, but the realisation was poor consolation to him, faced with a matching realisation that rather than seeing his men safely removed from the risks of a deteriorating campaign, his orders had landed them in one of the worst prisons in all of Scotland, branded as cowards, and sentenced to a shameful death by hanging. This, coupled with the imminent prospect of leaving the men in their dark, filthy imprisonment, to go to Stirling and face the humiliation of pleading with Charles, was more than sufficient to explain the look on Jamie's face, that of a man who has just breakfasted on broken glass. Young Simon also was silent, frowning, wide forehead creasing with thought.
"I'll come with you to His Highness," he said abruptly. "You will?"
Jamie glanced at his half-uncle in surprise, then his eyes narrowed at Simon.
"Why?"
Jamie gave a half-grin.
"Blood's blood, after all. Or do you think I try to claim your men, like Father did?" "Would you?"
"I might," Simon said frankly,
"if I thought there was a chance of it doing me some good. More likely to cause trouble, though, is what I think. I've no wish to fight with the Mackenzies, or you, Nevy," he added, the grin widening. "Rich as Lallybroch might be, it's a good long way from Bewley, and likely to be the devil of a fight to get hold of it, either by force or by the courts. I told Father so, but he hears what he wants to."
The young man shook his head and settled his sword belt around his hips.
"There's like to be better pickings with the army. Certainly, there will be with a restored king. And, he concluded, if that army's going to fight again like they did at Preston, they'll need every man they can get. I'll go with you, he repeated firmly.
Jamie nodded, a slow smile dawning on his face.
I thank you then, Simon. It'll be of help.
Simon nodded.
Aye, well, it wouldn't hurt matters any for you to ask Dougal Mackenzie to come speak for you either. He's in Edinburgh just now.
Dougal Mackenzie?
Jamie's brows rose quizzically.
Aye, I suppose it would do no harm, but...
Do no harm? Man, do you know here?
The Mackenzie's Prince Charles's fair-haired boy, the new...
Simon lounged back in his seat, looking mockingly at his half-nephew.
"What for?" I asked. "What on earth has he done?" Dougal had brought 250 men-at-arms to fight for the Stuart cause, but there were a number of chieftains who had made greater contributions.
£10,000, Simon said, savouring the words as he rolled them around on his tongue.
£10,000 in fine sterling Dougal Mackenzie's brought to lay at the feet of his sovereign.
And it will not come amiss either, he said matter-of-factly, dropping his lounging pose. Cameron was just telling me that Charles had gone through the last of the Spanish money and damn little coming in from the English supporters he'd counted on. Dougal's 10,000 will keep the army in weapons and food for a few more weeks at least, and with luck by then... he'll have got more from France.
At last, realising that his reckless cousin was providing him with an excellent distraction for the English, Louis was reluctantly agreeing to cough up a bit of money. It was a long time coming, though. I stared at Jamie, his face reflecting my own bewilderment. Where on earth would Dougal Mackenzie have gotten £10,000? Suddenly, I remembered where I had heard that sum mentioned once before. In the thieves' hole at Cranesmuir, where I had spent 3 endless days and nights awaiting trial on charges of witchcraft. "Gillis Duncan," I exclaimed. I felt cold at the memory of that conversation, carried out in the pitch blackness of a miry pit, my companion no more than a voice in the dark. The drawing-room fire was warm, but I pulled my cloak tighter around me.
"I diverted near on to £10,000, Gillis had said, boasting of the thefts accomplished by judicious forgery of her late husband's name. Arthur Duncan, whom she had killed by poison, had been the procurator fiscal for the district. £10,000 for the Jacobite cause. When it comes to rebellion, I shall know that I helped.
She stole it, I said, feeling a tremor run up my arms at the thought of Gillis Duncan, convicted of witchcraft, gone to a fiery death beneath the branches of a rowan tree. Gillis Duncan, who had escaped death just long enough to give birth to the child she bore to her lover, Dougal Mackenzie. She stole it, and she gave it to Dougal. Or he took it from her, no telling which now. Agitated, I stood up and paced back and forth before the fire. "Bastard," I said. "That's what he was doing in Paris 2 years ago."
"What?"
Jamie was frowning at me, Simon staring open-mouthed.
"Visiting Charles Stuart.
He came to see whether Charles was really planning a rebellion. Maybe he promised the money then. Maybe that's what encouraged Charles to risk coming to Scotland, the promise of Gillis Duncan's money. But Dougal couldn't give Charles the money openly while Colin was alive. Colin would have asked questions. He was much too honest a man to have used stolen money, no matter who stole it in the first place."
"I see."
Jamie nodded, eyes hooded in thought.
"But now Colin is dead," he said quietly, "and Dougal Mackenzie is the prince's favourite." "Which is all to the good for you, as I've been saying," Simon put in, impatient with talk of people he didn't know and matters he only half understood. "Go find him. Likely he'll be in the world's end at this time o' day."
"Do you think he'll speak to the prince for you?"
I asked Jamie, worried.
Dougal had been Jamie's foster father for a time, but the relationship had assuredly had its ups and downs.
Dougal might not want to risk his new-found popularity with the prince by speaking out for a bunch of cowards and deserters.
The young fox might lack his father's years, but he had a good bit of his sire's acumen. The heavy black brows quirked upward.
Mackenzie still wants Lallybroch, no? And if he thinks father and I might have an eye on reclaiming your land, he'll be more eager to help you get your men back, aye?
Cost him a lot more to fight us for it than to deal with you once the war's over.
He nodded, happily chewing his upper lip as he contemplated the ramifications of the situation.
I'll go weave a copy of father's list under his nose before you speak to him. You come in and tell him you'll see me in hell before you let me claim your men, and then we'll all go to Stirling together.
He grinned at Jamie complicitously.
I always thought there was some reason why Scott rhymed with plot, I remarked. What?
Both men looked up, startled.
Never mind, I said, shaking my head. Blood will tell.
I stayed in Edinburgh while Jamie and his two rival uncles rode to Stirling to straighten out matters with the prince. Under the circumstances, I couldn't stay at Holyrood House, but found lodgings in one of the wynds above the Canongate. It was a small, cold, cramped room, but I wasn't in it much. The Tolbooth prisoners couldn't come out, but there was nothing barring visitors who wanted to get in. Fergus and I visited the prison daily, and a small amount of discriminating bribery allowed me to pass food and medicine to the men from Lallybroch. Theoretically, I wasn't allowed to talk privately to the prisoners, but here again, the system had a certain amount of slip to it, when suitably greased, and I managed to talk alone with Ross the Smith on two or three occasions.
"'Twas my fault, lady,' he said at once, the first time I saw him. "'I should have had the sense to make the men go in small groups of three or four, not all together like we did. I was afraid of losing some, though. The most of them had never been more than 5 miles from home before.'
"'You needn't blame yourself,' I assured him. "'From what I heard, it was only ill luck that you were caught. "'Don't worry. Jamie has gone to see the prince at Stirling. "'He'll have you out of here in no time.'
He nodded, tiredly brushing back a lock of hair. He was filthy and unkempt, and a good bit diminished from the burly, robust craftsman he had been a few months before. Still, he smiled at me and thanked me for the food.
"'It will not come amiss,' he said frankly. "'It's little we get but slops. Do you think—'
He hesitated.
"'Do you think you might manage a few blankets, my lady?' I wouldn't ask. Only four of the men have the ague and...
I'll manage, I said. I left the prison wondering exactly how I would manage. While the main army had gone south to invade England, Edinburgh was still an occupied city, with soldiers, lords and hangers-on drifting constantly in and out. Goods of all sorts were high-priced and in short supply. Blankets and warm clothes could be found, but they would cost a lot, and I had precisely 10 shillings left in my purse. There was a banker in Edinburgh, a Mr. Waterford, who had in the past handled some of Lallybroch's business and investments. But Jamie had removed all his funds from the bank some months before, fearing that bank-held assets might be seized by the Crown. The money had been converted to gold, some of it sent to Jared in France for safekeeping, the rest of it hidden in the farmhouse, all of it equally inaccessible to me at the moment. I paused on the street to think, passers-by jostling past me on the cobbles. If I didn't have money, I had still a few things of value. The crystal Raymond had given me in Paris. While the crystal itself was of no particular value, its gold mounting and chain were. My wedding rings? No, I didn't want to part with those, even temporarily. But the pearls? I felt inside my pocket, checking to see that the pearl necklace Jamie had given me on our wedding day was still safely sewn into the seam of my skirt. It was. The small, irregular beads of the freshwater pearls were hard and smooth under my fingers. Not as expensive as Oriental pearls, but it was still a fine necklace, with gold-pierced work roundels between the pearls. It had belonged to Jamie's mother, Ellen. I thought she would have liked to see it used to comfort his men. "£5," I said firmly. "It's worth 10, and I could get 6 for it if I cared to walk all the way up the hill to another shop." I had no idea whether this was true or not, but I reached out as though to pick up the necklace from the counter anyway, pretending that I was about to leave the pawnbroker's shop. The pawnbroker, Mr. Samuels, placed a quick hand over the necklace, his eagerness letting me know that I should have asked £6 to start with.
£3.10, then, he said. It's beggaring me own family to do it, but for a fine lady like yourself.
The small bell over the shop door chimed behind me as the door opened, and there was a sound of hesitant footsteps on the worn boards of the pawn shop floor.
"Excuse me," began a girl's voice,
and I whirled around, pearl necklace forgotten, to see the shadow of the pawnbroker's balls falling across the face of Mary Hawkins. She had grown in the last year, and filled out as well. There was a new maturity and dignity in her manner, but she was still very young. She blinked once, and then fell on me with a shriek of joy, her fur collar tickling my nose as she hugged me tight.
"What are you doing here?"
I asked, disentangling myself at last.
"Father's sister lives here," she replied. "I'm staying with her. Or do you mean, why am I here?"
She waved a hand at the dingy confines of Mr. Samuel's emporium. "Well, that too," I said, "but that can wait a bit." I turned to the pawnbroker. £4.06, or I'll walk up the hill," I told him. "Make up your mind. I'm in a hurry." Grumbling to himself, Mr. Samuels reached beneath his counter for the cash box as I turned back to Mary.
"I have to buy some blankets. Can you come with me?"
She glanced outside to where a small man in a footman's livery stood by the door, clearly waiting for her.
"Yes, if you'll come with me afterward. Oh, Claire, I'm so glad to see you."
"He sent a message to me," Mary confided as we walked down the hill.
"Alex. A friend brought me his letter."
Her face glowed as she spoke his name, but there was a small frown between her brows as well.
"When I found he was in Edinburgh, I made Father send me to visit Aunt Mildred. He didn't mind," she added bitterly. "It made him ill to look at me, after what happened in Paris. He was happy to get me out of his house."
"So you've seen Alex?" I asked. I wondered how the young curate had fared since I had last seen him. I also wondered how he had found the courage to write to Mary.
"Yes. He didn't ask me to come," she added quickly. "I came by myself."
Her chin lifted in defiance, but there was a small quiver as she said,
He wouldn't have written to me, but he thought he was dying, and he wanted me to know. To know."
I put an arm about her shoulders, and turned quickly into one of the closes, standing with her out of the flow of jostling street traffic.
"It's all right,"
I said to her, patting her helplessly, knowing that nothing I could do would make it right.
"You came, and you've seen him. That's the important thing."
She nodded, speechless, and blew her nose.
"Yes," she said thickly at last. "We've had 2 months. I keep telling myself that that's more than most people ever have, 2 months of happiness. But we lost so much time that we might have had, and it's not enough, Claire. It isn't enough."
"No," I said quietly. "A lifetime isn't enough for that kind of love." With a sudden pang, I wondered where Jamie was and how he was faring. Mary, more composed now, clutched me by the sleeve.
"Claire, can you come with me to see him? I know there's not much you can do.
Her voice faltered, and she steadied it with a visible effort.
But maybe you could help.
She caught my look at the footman, who stood stolidly outside the wind, oblivious to the passing traffic.
I pay him, she said simply. My aunt thinks I go walking every afternoon. Will you come?
Yes, of course. I glanced between the towering buildings, judging the level of the sun over the hills outside the city. It would be dark in an hour. I wanted the blankets delivered to the prison before night made the damp stone walls of the toll booth still colder. Making a sudden decision, I turned to Fergus, who had been standing patiently next to me, watching Mary with interest. Returned to Edinburgh with the rest of the Lallybroch men, he had escaped imprisonment by virtue of his French citizenship, and had survived hardily by reverting to his customary trade. I had found him faithfully hanging about near the toll booth, where he brought bits of food for his imprisoned companions. "Take this money," I said, handing him my purse, "and find Murtaugh. Tell him to get as many blankets as that will buy, and see they're taken to the jailkeeper at the toll booth. He's been bribed already, but keep back a few shillings just in case."
"But, madame," he protested, "I promised Milor I would not let you go alone."
"Milor isn't here," I said firmly, "and I am. Go, Fergus." He glanced from me to Mary. Evidently decided she was less a threat to me than my temper was to him, and departed, shrugging his shoulders and muttering in French about the stubbornness of women. The little room at the top of the building had changed considerably since my last visit. It was clean, for one thing, with polish gleaming on every horizontal surface. There was food in the hutch, a down quilt on the bed, and numerous small comforts provided for the patient. Mary had confided on the way that she had been quietly pawning her mother's jewellery to ensure that Alex Randall was as comfortable as money could make him. There were limits to what money could manage, but Alex's face glowed like a candle flame when Mary came through the door, temporarily obscuring the ravages of illness.
"I've brought Claire, dearest."
Mary dropped her cloak unheeded onto a chair and knelt beside him, taking his thin blue-veined hands in her own.
"Mrs. Fraser."
His voice was light and breathless, though he smiled at me.
"It's good to see a friendly face again."
"Yes, it is." I smiled at him, noting half-consciously the rapid fluttering pulse visible in his throat and the transparency of his skin. The hazel eyes were soft and warm, holding most of the life left in his frail body. Lacking medicine, there was nothing I could do for him, but I examined him carefully and saw him tucked up comfortably afterward, his lips slightly blue from the minor exertion of the examination. I covered the anxiety I felt at his condition and promised to come next day with some medicine to help him sleep more easily. He hardly noticed my assurances. All his attention was for Mary, sitting anxiously by him, holding his hand. I saw her glance at the window, where light was fading rapidly, and realized her concern. She would have to return to her aunt's house before nightfall. "I'll take my leave, then," I told Alex, removing myself as tactfully as I could, to leave them a few precious moments alone together. He glanced from me to Mary, then smiled back at me in gratitude.
"God bless you, Mrs. Fraser," he said.
"I'll see you tomorrow," I said, and left, hoping that I would. I was busy over the next few days. The men's arms had been confiscated, of course, when they were arrested, and I did my best to recover what I could, bullying and threatening, bribing and charming where necessary. I pawned two brooches that Jared had given me as a farewell present, and bought enough food to ensure that the men of Lallybroch ate as well as the army in general, poorly as that might be. I talked my way into the cells of the prison, and spent some time in treating the prisoners' ailments, ranging from scurvy and the more generalized malnutrition common in winter, to chafing sores, chilblains, arthritis, and a variety of respiratory ailments. I made the rounds of those chieftains and lords still in Edinburgh, not many, who might be helpful to Jamie if his visit to Stirling should fail. I didn't think it would, but it seemed wise to take precautions. And among the other activities of my days, I made time to see Alex Randall once a day. I took pains to come in the mornings, so as not to use up his time with Mary. Alex slept little, and that little, ill. Consequently, he tended to be tired and drooping in the morning, not wanting to talk, but always smiling in welcome when I arrived. I would give him a light mixture of mint and lavender, with a few drops of poppy syrup stirred in. This would generally allow him a few hours of sleep, so that he could be alert when Mary arrived in the afternoon. Aside from me and Mary, I'd seen no other visitors at the top of the building. I was therefore surprised, coming up the stairs to his room one morning, to hear voices behind the closed door. I knocked once, briefly, as was our agreed custom, and let myself in. Jonathan Randall was sitting by his brother's bed, clad in his captain's uniform of red and fawn. He rose at my entrance and bowed correctly, face cold. "Madam," he said. "Captain," I said. We then stood awkwardly in the middle of the room, staring at each other, each unwilling to go further. "Johnny," said Alex's hoarse voice from the bed. It had a note of coaxing as well as one of command, and his brother shrugged irritably when he heard it.
"My brother has summoned me to give you a bit of news," he said, tight-lipped.
He wore no wig this morning, and with his dark hair tied back, his resemblance to his brother was startling. Pale and frail as Alex was, he looked like Jonathan's ghost.
"You and Mr. Fraser have been kind to my Mary," Alex said,
rolling onto his side to look at me.
"And to me as well. I knew of my brother's bargain with you."
The faintest of pinks rose in his cheeks.
"But I know, too, what you and your husband did for Mary. In Paris."
He licked his lips, cracked and dry from the constant heat in the room.
"I think you should hear the news Johnny brought from the castle yesterday."
Jack Randall eyed me with dislike, but he was good as his word.
"Hawley has succeeded Cope, as I told you earlier that he would," he said. "Hawley has little gift for leadership, bar a certain blind confidence in the men under his command. Whether that will stand him in better stead than did Cope's cannon."
He shrugged impatiently.
"Be that as it may, General Hawley has been directed to march north to recover Stirling Castle."
"Has he?"
I said.
"Do you know how many troops he has?" Randall nodded shortly.
"He has 8,000 troops at the moment, 1,300 of them cavalry. He is also in daily expectation of the arrival of 6,000 Hessians."
He frowned, thinking.
"I have heard that the chief of Clan Campbell is sending 1,000 men to join with Hawley's forces as well, but I cannot say whether that information is reliable. There seems no way of predicting what Scots will do."
"I see." This was serious. The Highland army at this point had between 6,000 and 7,000 men. Against Hawley, minus his expected reinforcements, they might manage. To wait until his Hessians and Campbells arrived was clearly madness, to say nothing of the fact that the Highlanders' fighting skills were much better suited to attack than defence. This news had best reach Lord George Murray at once. Jack Randall's voice called me back from my ruminations.
"Good day to you, madam,"
he said, formal as ever, and there was no trace of humanity on the hard, handsome features as he bowed to me and took his leave. "Thank you," I said to Alex Randall, waiting for Jonathan to descend the long, twisting stair before leaving myself. "I appreciate it very much." He nodded. The shadows under his eyes were pronounced. Another bad night.
"You're welcome," he said simply. "I suppose you'll be leaving some of the medicine for me.
I imagine it may be some time before I see you again.
I halted, struck by his assumption that I would go myself to Stirling. That was what every fibre of my being urged me to do, but there was the matter of the men in the toll booth to be considered.
I don't know, I said, but yes, I'll leave the medicine. I walked slowly back to my lodgings, my mind still spinning. Obviously, I must get word to Jamie immediately.
Murtaugh would have to go, I supposed. Jamie would believe me, of course, if I wrote him a note. But could he convince Lord George, the Duke of Perth, or the other army commanders? I couldn't tell him where I'd come by this knowledge. Would the commanders be willing to believe a woman's unsupported written word? Even the word of a woman popularly supposed to have supernatural powers.
I thought of Marsery suddenly, and shivered.
"It's a curse," she had said.
"Yes, but what choice was there?"
"I have no power but the power not to say what I know."
I had that power too, but dared not risk using it.
To my surprise, the door to my small room was open, and there were clashing, banging noises coming from inside it. I'd been storing the recovered arms under my bed, and stacking swords and assorted blades by the half once the space under the bed was filled, until there was virtually no floor space left, save the small square of floorboards where Fergus laid his blankets. I stood on the stair, amazed at the scene visible through the open door above. Murtaugh, standing on the bed, was overseeing the handing out of weaponry to the men who crowded the room to overflowing. The men of Lallybroch.
Madame!
I turned at the cry to find Fergus at my elbow, beaming up at me, a square-toothed grin on his sallow face.
Madame, is it not wonderful? Milor has received pardon for his men. A messenger came from Stirling this morning with the order to release them, and we are ordered at once to rejoin Milor at Stirling.
I hugged him, grinning a bit myself.
That is wonderful, Fergus.
A few of the men had noticed me, and were beginning to turn to me, smiling and plucking at each other's sleeves. An air of exhilaration and excitement filled the small room.
Murtaugh, perched on the bedstead like the gnome king on a toadstool, saw me then, and smiled, an expression which rendered him virtually unrecognisable, so much did it transform his face.
"Will Mr. Murtaugh take the men to Stirling?" Fergus asked.
He had received a whinger, or short sword, as his share of the weaponry, and was practising drawing and sheathing it as he spoke. I met Murtaugh's eyes and shook my head. After all, I thought, if Jenny Cameron could lead her brother's men to Glenfinnan, I could take my husband's troops to Stirling. And just let Lord George and His Highness try to disregard my news, delivered in person.
"No," I said. "I will."
Chapter 43. Falkirk. I could feel the men close by, all around me in the dark. There was a piper walking next to me. I could hear the creak of the bag under his arm and see the outline of the drones poking out behind. They moved as he walked, so that he seemed to be carrying a small, feebly struggling animal. I knew him, a man named Leivraen MacIan. The pipers of the clans took it in turns to call the dawn at Stirling, walking to and fro in the encampment with the piper's measured stride, so that the wail of the drones bounced from the flimsy tents, calling all within to the battle of the new day. Again, in the evening, a single piper would come out, strolling slow across the yard, and the camp would stop to listen, voices stilling and the glow of the sunset fading from the tent's canvas. The high whining notes of the pibroch called down the shadows from the moor, and when the piper was done, the night had come. Evening or morning, Leivraen MacIan played with his eyes closed, stepping sure and slow across the yard and back, elbow tight on the bag, and his fingers lively on the chanter's holes. Despite the cold, I sat sometimes to watch in the evenings, letting the sound drive its spikes through my heart. McKeon paced to and fro, ignoring everything around him, making his turns on the ball of his foot, pouring his being out through his chanter. There are the small Irish pipes, used indoors for making music, and the great northern pipes, used outdoors for reveille, and for calling of clans to order, and the spurring of men to battle. It was the northern pipes that McKeon played, walking to and fro with his eyes shut tight. Rising from my seat as he finished one evening, I waited while he pressed the last of the air from his bag with a dying wail, and fell in alongside him as he came in through Stirling's gate with a nod to the guard.
"Good e'en to you, mistress," he said.
His voice was soft, and his eyes, now open, softer still with the unbroken spell of his playing still on him. "Good evening to you, McKeon," I said. "I wondered, McKeon, why do you play with your eyes tight shut?" He smiled and scratched his head, but answered readily enough.
"I suppose it is because my grandsire taught me, mistress, and he was blind. I see him always when I play, pacing the shore with his beard flying in the wind, and his blind eyes closed against the sting of the sand, hearing the sound of the pipes come down to him off the rocks of the cliff side, and knowing from that where he was in his walk."
"So you see him, and you play, too, to the cliffs and the sea?" "From where do you come, McKeon?" I asked. His speech was low and sibilant, even more than that of most Highlanders.
"It is from the Shetlands, mistress," he replied,
making the last word almost Zetlands,
"a long way from here."
He smiled again, and bowed to me as we came to the guest quarters where I would turn.
"But then, I am thinking that you have come farther still, mistress."
"That's true," I said. "Good night, McKeon." Later that week, I wondered whether his skill at playing unseeing would help him here in the dark. A large body of men moving makes a good bit of noise, no matter how quietly they go. But I thought any echoes they created would be drowned in the howl of the rising wind. The night was moonless, but the sky was light with clouds, and an icy sleet was falling, stinging my cheeks. The men of the Highland Army covered the ground in small groups of 10 or 20, moving in uneven bumps and patches, as though the earth thrust up small hillocks here and there, or as though the groves of larch and alder were walking through the dark. My news had not come unsupported. Ewan Cameron's spies had reported Hawley's moves as well, and the Scottish army was now on its way to meet him, somewhere south of Stirling Castle. Jamie had given up urging me to go back. I'd promised to stay out of the way, but if there was a battle to be fought, then the army's physicians must be at hand afterward. I could tell when his attention shifted to his men and the prospects ahead by the sudden cock of his head. On Donas, he sat high enough to be visible as a shadow, even in the dark, and when he threw up an arm, two smaller shadows detached themselves from the moving mass and came up beside his stirrup. There was a moment's whispered conversation. Then he straightened in his saddle and turned to me.
"The scouts say we've been seen. English guards have gone flying for Callander House to warn General Hawley. We shall no wait longer. I'm taking my men and circling beyond Dougal's troops to the far side of Falkirk Hill. We'll come down from behind as the Mackenzies come in from the west. There's a wee kirk up the hill to your left, maybe a quarter mile. That's your place, Sassenach. Ride there now and stay."
He groped for my arm in the darkness, found it, and squeezed.
"I shall come for you when I can, or send Murtagh if I can't. If things should go wrong, go into the kirk and claim sanctuary there. It's the best I can think of."
"Don't worry about me," I said. My lips were cold, and I hoped my voice didn't sound as shaky as I felt. I bit back the "be careful" that would have been my next words, and contented myself with touching him quickly, the cold surface of his cheek hard as metal under my hand, and the brush of a lock of hair, cold and smooth as a deer's pelt. I reined to the left, picking my way slowly as the oncoming men flowed around me. The gelding was excited by the stir. He tossed his head, snorting, and fidgeted under me. I pulled him up sharply, as Jamie had taught me, and kept a close rein as the ground sloped suddenly up beneath the horse's hooves. I glanced back once, but Jamie had disappeared into the night, and I needed all my attention to find the church in the dark. It was a tiny building, stone with a thatched roof, crouched in a small depression of the hill like a cowering animal. I felt a strong feeling of kinship with it. The English watchfires were visible from here, glimmering through the sleet, and I could hear shouting in the distance. Scots or English, I couldn't tell. Then the pipes began, a thin, eerie scream in the storm. There were discordant shrieks rising unearthly from several different places on the hill. Having seen it before, at close hand, I could imagine the pipers blowing up their bags, chests inflating with quick gasps and blue lips clamped tight on the chanter's stems, cold, stiff fingers fumbling to guide the blowing into coherence. I could almost feel the stubborn resistance of the leathern bag, kept warm and flexible under a plaid, but reluctant to be coaxed into fullness. Then suddenly, springing to life, part of the piper's body, like a third lung, breathing for him when the wind stole his breath, as though the shouting of the clansmen near him filled it. The shouting was louder now, and reached me in waves as the wind turned, carrying eddying blasts of sleet. There was no porch to give shelter, or any trees on the hillside to break the wind. My horse turned, and put his head down, facing into the wind, and his mane whipped hard against my face, rough with ice. The church offered sanctuary from the elements, as well as from the English. I pushed the door open, and tugging on the bridle, led the horse inside after me. It was dark inside, with a single oiled-skin window no more than a dim patch in the blackness over the altar. It seemed warm, by contrast with the weather outside, but the smell of stale sweat made it suffocating. There were no seats for the horse to knock over. Nothing save a small shrine set into one wall and the altar itself. Oppressed by the strong smell of people, the horse stood still, snorting and blowing, but not fidgeting over much. Keeping a wary eye on him, I went back to the door and thrust my head out. No one could tell what was happening on Falkirk Hill. The sparks of gunfire twinkled randomly in the dark. I could hear faint and intermittent the ring of metal and the thump of an occasional explosion. Now and then came the scream of a wounded man, high as a bagpipe screech, different from the Gallic cries of the warriors. And then the wind would turn, and I would hear nothing, or would imagine I heard voices that were nothing but the shrieking wind. I hadn't seen the fight at Prestonpans, subconsciously accustomed to the ponderous movements of huge armies bound to tanks and mortars. I hadn't realised just how quickly things could happen in a small pitched battle of hand-to-hand fighting and small light arms. The first warning I had was a shout from near at hand. "To la garde!" Deafened by wind, I hadn't heard them as they came up the hill. "To la garde!" It was the battle cry of Clan Mackenzie, some of Dougal's troops forced backward in the direction of my sanctuary. I ducked back inside, but kept the door ajar so that I could peer out. They were coming up the hill, a small group of men in flight, Highlanders both from the sound and the sight of them, plaids and beards and hair flying around them, so they looked like black clouds against the grassy slope, scudding uphill before the wind. I jumped back into the church as the first of them burst through the door. Dark as it was, I couldn't see his face, but I recognised his voice when he crashed headfirst into my horse.
"Jesus!"
"Willie!" I shouted. "Willie Coulter!"
"Sweet bleeding Jesus, who's that?"
I hadn't time to answer before the door crashed against the wall and two more black forms shot into the tiny church. Incensed by this noisy intrusion, my horse reared and whinnied, pawing the air. This gave rise to cries of alarm from the intruders, who clearly had thought the building unoccupied and were disconcerted to find otherwise. The entrance of several more men only increased the confusion, and I gave up any idea of trying to subdue the horse. Forced to the rear of the church, I squeezed myself into the small space between altar and wall and waited for things to sort themselves out. They began to show signs of doing so when one of the confused voices in the darkness rose above the others.
"Be quiet," it shouted,
in a tone that brooked no opposition. Everyone but the horse obeyed, and as the racket died down, even the horse subsided, backing into a corner and making snorting noises, mixed with querulous squeals of disgust.
"It is Mackenzie of Leoch," said the imperious voice. "Who else bides here?"
"It is Jordi, Dougal, and my brother with me," said a voice nearby, in tones of profound relief. "We've brought Rupert with us, too. He's wounded. Christ, I thought it was the deil himself in here."
"Gordon MacLeod of Ardsmuir," said another voice I didn't recognise.
"And you and Cameron of Kinnoch," said another. "Whose is the horse?"
"Mine," I said, sidling cautiously out from behind the altar. The sound of my voice caused another outbreak, but Dougal put a stop to it once more, raising his own voice above the racket.
"Quiet, damn the lot of you! Is that you, Claire Freezer?"
"Well, it isn't the Queen," I said testily. "Willie Coulter's in here too, or he was a minute ago. Hasn't anyone got a flint box?"
"No light," said Dougal.
"Little chance that the English will overlook this place if they follow us, but little sense in drawing their attention to it if they don't."
"All right," I said, biting my lip. "Rupert, can you talk? Say something so I can tell where you are." I didn't know how much I could do for him in the dark. As it was, I couldn't even reach my medicine box. Still, I couldn't leave him to bleed to death on the floor. There was a nasty-sounding cough from the side of the church opposite me, and a hoarse voice said,
"Here, lass,"
and coughed again. I felt my way across the floor, cursing under my breath. I could tell merely from the bubbling sound of that cough that it was bad, the sort of bad that my medicine box wasn't likely to help. I crouched and duck-walked the last few feet, waving my arms in a wide swathe to feel what might be in my way. One hand struck a warm body, and a big hand fastened onto me. It had to be Rupert. I could hear him breathing, a stertorous sound, with a faint gurgle behind it. "I'm here," I said, patting him blindly in what I hoped was a reassuring spot. I supposed it was, because he gave a sort of gasping chuckle and arched his hips, pressing my hand down hard against him.
"Do that again, lass, and I'll forget all about the musket ball," he said.
I grabbed my hand back. "Perhaps a bit later," I said dryly. I moved my hand upward, skimming over his body in search of his head. The thick bristle of beard told me I'd reached my goal, and I felt carefully under the dense growth for the pulse in his throat. Fast and light, but still fairly regular. His forehead was slick with sweat, though his skin felt clammy to the touch. The tip of his nose was cold when I brushed it, chilled from the air outside.
"Pity I'm no a dog," he said,
a thread of laughter coming between the gasps for air.
"Cold nose would be a good sign."
"Be a better sign if you'd quit talking," I said. "Where did the ball take you?"
"No, don't tell me. Take my hand and put it on the wound."
"And if you put it anywhere else, Rupert Mackenzie, you can die here like a dog, and good riddance to you."
I could feel the wide chest vibrate with suppressed laughter under my hand. He drew my hand slowly under his plaid, and I pushed back the obstructing fabric with my other hand.
"All right, I've got it," I whispered.
I could feel the small tear in his shirt, damp with blood round the edges, and I put both hands to it and ripped it open. I brushed my fingers very lightly down his side, feeling the ripple of goose flesh under them, and then the small hole of the entrance wound. It seemed a remarkably small hole,
compared to the bulk of Rupert, who was a burly man. "Did it come out anywhere?" I whispered. The inside of the church was quiet except for the horse, who was moving restlessly in his own corner. With the door closed,